Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Mosaics. Today we're doing a special part two on the topic of the profound treasury of the ocean of Dharma. This special part two is going to take a look at the history, the context of all of the seminaries that happened between 1973 and 1986. And there probably was no better person to do that than Miss Sarah Coleman. Sarah Coleman is an old-time practitioner and student of Trungpa Rinpoche and also Sakyamnipa Rinpoche, who had the great good fortune of being at almost every seminary, and the ones that she was not at, she was part of the team that put together the transcripts that eventually provided the basic material for the Profound Treasury. And I had the great good fortune myself of talking to Sarah in the Republic of Malta in the summer of 2013. And what we have gathered here in a four-part series is her recollection of each one of the seminaries. We have divided it into four parts. The first part will take you to Sarah's recollection of the 1973 seminary. The second part is the years 74, 75, and 76. There was no 1977 seminary. Then we take you to 1978 and 1979, which is the third part. And then at the end, the fourth part, we have Sarah talk about years 1980 to 1986. So I'd like to welcome Sarah to our Mosaic show. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Sarah. Glad to be here.
Good. Sarah, how did you meet Trungpa Rinpoche?
Oh, it's sort of a long story. I'll try and make it a little short, but basically, I was a wreck. I met Rinpoche when I was 19 years old, and I basically was so shy. Can you imagine this? I was completely quiet, and I was not interested at all. I met someone. I wanted to go to Europe for the first time. I was dropping out of school for the last time, and some friends, we decided to go to Europe together. In order to go to Europe, we had to get jobs and make money. I was living in New York City, and when the school closed down, we got kicked out of the dormitory, and I needed a place to live for another month so that I could make enough money to go to Europe for the first time. And there was a young man at the place where I worked who kept trying to flirt with me. I was too shy to talk to him, and he had this unbelievably huge grin, which really was demonic to me. I eventually went out to dinner with him and managed to tell him a little bit of my situation. And he told me all this stuff. He was into meditation. He talked to me about meditation and about magic and how the world really was dependent on what you believed. And I thought, this man is brain dead. He's a moron. He's a complete idiot. So he heard I needed a place to live, and he said I could come stay with him for a month. And this tells you who Sarah was then. I said to myself, well, he's clearly such an idiot. It's okay. I can go stay with him, because even if he falls in love with me, I don't have to worry about it because he's clearly brain dead. So this was Eric Weiss, who you might remember. Other people won't know. I'm far from an idiot in any case. But I stayed
very
with him for
quite handsome.
One of our very, very accomplished early teachers and a philosophy major at Columbia. Yeah. But anyhow, I stayed with him for a month. And you want the real story? I don't know how you edit this out if you need to. The last night before I went to Europe, people showed up to say goodbye, and people brought lots of drugs. and do you want this?
Yeah.
Yeah, we took lots of drugs, and in a very drugged state and a real, as things were in those days, a potpourri of God knows what in us. Somehow Eric and I decided at the end of that evening that we were in love and that when I came back from Europe, we were going to live together. And also, just sort of casually, I didn't really admit it to myself, but this crazy stuff he was saying, I stopped thinking he was a moron. I thought, well, it's a little interesting, but not for me. So I went to Europe for 3 months, hitchhiked everywhere. When I came back, Eric had become the coordinator of the New York City Dharmadhatu, which was what it was called back then. Eric and Judy were used to be married. Leaf. Yeah, Eric Holm and Judy Leaf were married. Eric had been the coordinator, and they had taken off to Boulder.
Judy Leaf was married to Eric once?
Yes, for many years. To Eric Holm.
Oh, Eric Holm. Okay.
To Lodro Dorje. Okay. Yeah, so they had left. So Eric Weiss had become the coordinator. And 4 days after I got back, Trungpa Rinpoche came to New York City.
And what year was that?
This is 1972. And he gave a talk in Central Park West called Beyond Neurotic Speed. And I, because Eric was the coordinator, I went in order to help him. I took tickets at the gate. And thinking the whole time to myself, really, that never changed. This is the most idiotic thing possible. A bunch of Western hippies running around after a Tibetan guru. How stupid can you get? And what happened? I'd already heard rumors that Rinpoche was always late. So, but I had not put this together in my head right, what this meant for me as a really critically, paralyzingly shy person. Meant I had to stay in front and keep selling tickets till he came. He came in and whooshed past me in this big fancy church on Central Park West, and I had to close up the little cash box, and then I realized what it meant was that I had to walk into this huge church down the central aisle in front of 400 people with Trungpa Rinpoche sitting on the chair in front of the shrine. This is death. So I had very long hair, which was all on my face, and I there was no choice. I really had to go in there. So I took this big gulp and walked in with all my hair on my face and got about 10 steps in and realized it was even worse. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know where Eric was sitting. So I had to look up. There was just no choice. So I remember I peered up through my hair, and there in front of me was Trungpa Rinpoche sitting in front of the Catholic altar. And I did not see him. What I really saw, I saw his head, which looked like this. So this is about 4 foot. It looked perfectly round, like a big pumpkin, about four and a half feet across. And he had a smile from one ear to the other, and these eyes. And the eyes looked right, not only at me, into me. He was inside me. It was one of the most scary things that ever happened. Oh, and he was smiling. I mean, there was just like this, it's like a wave of honey. You've heard that about him before. You know, there was just this incredible blast of warmth. And I had a shot of adrenaline like nobody's business. I tucked my head down and ran to Eric and sat down. And that was it. It was over. It took me a few months to understand. I mean, to realize that I was caught. I started sitting, but I was sitting just to keep Eric company for a long time. But that's how I got together with Trungpa Rinpoche.
But if this was 1972 and you ended up in the 73 seminary, yes, things moved pretty fast. Did you get to know Trungpa Rinpoche? Did you come to accompany Eric?
Oh, no. We all had to apply to seminary. This is going to be very funny to people. From other people from those days. Seminary, the way we applied to seminary in those days, I mean, he made up the program. The word came out, he wanted to do it. And what you had to do was send a photograph of yourself with your name written on the back.
That was it.
That was the
first application to seminary.
Yeah. And I got rejected. And that's a whole other story. But he let me in at the very last minute, like 2 days before seminary started. I had him on the phone, and he said, come to seminary. So I went to seminary. And seminary cost less than my sublet in New York City. It cost, ready, 3 full months program with Trungpa Rinpoche in residence cost $450.
So, in a splendid place in the mountains of Wales.
Gorgeous. Teton Village, a ski resort in the Teton Mountains, yeah. So that's how I met Trungpa Rinpoche. But in terms of knowing him, everybody knew him then. You know, he came and he used to come, you know, he came after that thing, and already I was introduced to him that night. There were not many people there. When I joined the New York Dharmadhatu as a member, I was the 14th paying member of the New York City Dharmadhatu. And that night after that talk, we went to there was a little reception for Rinpoche. He was at Helen Conrad's. It wasn't even Helen Berliner yet. apartment somewhere in the West Village, and Chuck and Carl were there, and one of them, you know, they all talked to me and said, what do you think? And I said, I think it's a bunch of bullshit. And then I went, but the people are interesting. And I still, I don't know which of them said it, but one of it looked at the other and went with his album and said, she's hooked. They were right. That's how I met him.
So one of the things that we really want to devote the time that we're going to spend together this afternoon is to your experience in quite a number of seminaries. I mean, there were 13 seminaries, of which you probably, seems like you participated in about 8 or 9 of them, pretty much, and visited some of the others, and the ones that you missed were just few, and you probably went to some of the events related to the seminary, so we could probably do a chronology of Trungpa Rinpoche's teaching style to what we could say is his older students, you know, trying to bring them from Hinayana students through the Mahayana and the Vajrayana. And hopefully your piece will appear along with Judy Leaf's interview where she talks about the Profound Treasury, which is her her compilation of what was actually taught at that time.
Yeah, and just to mention it, even the ones where I wasn't there, I worked in the editorial department, so I edited the seminary transcripts, even the ones where I wasn't there. That was one of my main projects. I worked on them.
And I think you told me that you were known as the cut and paste lady because you actually were helping Judy in some of the first attempts at trying to put together the Profound Treasury and other things too, like the vows. And
yeah, we did the vow articles that were in Garuda. In those days, our names didn't get put on anything. But yeah, my memory's a little different than Judy's. I remember doing the cut and paste for the vow articles. And, you know, there was really nothing else to do. I did the refuge vow article, and Judy did the bodhisattva vow article. But my memory is, like Judy's, is very pathetic. So she might well be right that we also did it when we first tried to do what we then were calling the conscript project, the compendium of the transcripts conscript.
So, yeah. And Garuda being one of the very first sort of newsletter, small publication to bring forth Trungpa Rinpoche's teachings without having to have a formal book.
Yeah.
Okay, Sarah, so let's begin at the beginning. So, kapoom, there you are, Teton Village, 1973.
Yeah.
What was going on at the time? What was he like? What did he look like? What did the people look like? What were the teachings like? What was the flavor? Take me through, and all of our listeners, the context in which these teachings were given in the years of the seminaries that you went to or had something to do with, or edited for that matter.
Okay, so 73 was the very first seminary, and none of us knew what to expect. I was still in this state of chronic shyness, so my contact with people was probably a little different than other people who were there, but it seemed, in retrospect, a fairly random group of people. There were some of the senior students. I was not one of the senior students, so I felt terribly poverty-stricken about it all. They'd all been sitting at least 6 months, if not a whole year longer than me, and they were much older than me, like at least 2 years older than me.
And they knew words like vaivashika.
Yeah, there were some real scholars. So there were some of his very senior students, and there were also some just absolutely random people who he seemed to have bumped into before the program started and invited.
Alan, like John Perks.
Like John Perks, and like you.
Like me.
Yes.
Allen Ginsberg. And
Allen was there, and, you know, he Bhagavan Das was there. I thought I'd wandered into the pages of history. I thought it was really cool. I shared a wall with Allen Ginsberg. I thought we were important because Allen Ginsberg was there. And it was a very motley crew. It was not many people. I'm not sure how many, best 90, of my memory. That many? I thought it was 60-some.
Really?
Could be. I really don't know. And many of those people disappeared. The core of old students all stayed. I would say this core. So, and the way it worked in those days is basically it was pretty much divided into 2 weeks, 2 weeks. 2 weeks sitting, 2 weeks study period, Hinayana. 2 weeks sitting, 2 weeks Mahayana. And then Vajrayana. And the sitting was pathetic. There was no discipline whatsoever. I think there were about 10 people there who had some discipline, and the rest of us regarded those people as religious maniacs.
And some people sat facing the wall rather than...
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, I think it was Franny Lewis sat facing the wall or something.
Well, Franny Lewis was hardly ever in the room. Franny was our pipeline to the village. Franny went every day during sitting to town. She and went to the used clothing market, the used markets, and she also would buy used books. She kept us supplied with our reading material, which was Richie Rich comic books, True Confessions magazines, God knows what else, and used clothes. And, we didn't sit a lot. Although, for us, it was a lot of sitting. I think everyone, there was enough pressure that you felt that you should at least go in there for part of the day every day. I slept in very late. This was the last year we did these seminaries in hotels, since, you know, hotel rooms have telephones in them. After this, the telephones were cut off during seminary, but in this year, the telephones were connected, and I remember very clearly lying in bed 2 in the afternoon reading God knows what kind of crap, True Confessions magazines or comic books, and the phone would ring, and I would pick it up, and it would be Rinpoche, and he would say, "Hello, what are you doing, sweetie? Maybe you could go sit." So he lived down the road. He didn't live in the building with us. During that time, how was he? He gave talks during the study periods. He talked every single day. Those transcripts are a Bible of sorts. He unfolded just masses of material about the yanas, you know, all kinds of stuff. He was really laying the ground for all kinds of things. So full of material, and he talked for hours every day. He was supposed to talk, I believe, about 4 in the afternoon is my memory, and we were supposed to have dinner afterwards. Frequently, we didn't have dinner till 9:30, 10 at night. He would just keep talking. He had one pair of clothes that he wore, as my memory. It was blue jeans with a sort of a red checked flannel, plaid flannel shirt.
And there were khaki blue jeans.
Were they khaki? Yeah. And he had suspenders and high-top sneakers. And he wore those clothes
every
single day. And he would get into that room and start teaching in just hours. And unbelievable stuff. And you could see around the room, there's most of us there were powerfully, powerfully connected with him, I would say. One way or another, to have wound up there at all. Some people understood a lot of what he said. Most of us understood relatively little. Didn't matter. You were there. You were in his mind with him. And, you know, particularly when he got to the Vajrayana section, you could see people's resistance to the different kinds of material was visible. He would start talking about something, and a third of the room, people would just fall asleep. You could hear their pens drop out of their hands and taking notes, and then he would change the topic, and those people would wake up, and another 30% of the people would go plunk and just check out. So it was very, very intense. And during that seminary, he traveled a fair amount. He came and went several times, and it became a joke at the seminary because we didn't actually know when he was coming and going, since he didn't stay in the seminary with us. But every time he came back, there would be a rainbow. And you would see the rainbow, and he was like, oh, Rinpoche must be back. And this is true, because this is also partly how it was in the very early days. There was a lot of stuff that seemed to be really magical. He really did stuff that was very, very magical, but he did it in a way that you were never sure that he'd really done it, so you couldn't trip out. So it woke you up, because it wasn't normal, but you weren't quite sure if you were making it up or not, and that was very typical. So that was a part of the environment. And we don't have that much time. And do you want to hear the Vajrayana story? So this was a historical thing. Okay, so there was that. Then there were several other classes taught by senior students. Sherub taught one, Bill Indich. Yeah, he was then Michael Cohn. Bill Indich taught one. I think John Baker taught one. Maybe Jeremy taught one, I don't know. None of those were very important. But one, for instance, he had Madhyamaka was being taught. Who knows? I don't remember very much. I remember much more about Rinpoche. That was the main thing happening.
And you remember that the shrine room was a bit of a mess. It had 20 million different kinds of cushions.
Yeah, we didn't have any. We were all sitting on Zafu still. People mostly brought their own. I don't remember much about what it looked like. It was small. The other thing, this was standard for all those years when we had programs in the... we were in off-season ski lodges, and the only room big enough for meditation hall was always the dining room. They always had these horrific carpets, and because they were the dining room, for the ski resorts, they always had these huge picture window looking out on the ski slopes on the hill. And this was also, this is the one and only year we sat facing the picture window, which is a source of enormous entertainment. A moose came by, a bear came by, you know, any little thing would blow by and the whole room would burst out laughing. That would be the end of meditation for 2 hours. That was sort of the environment in there. After that, again, it got changed. Never again, at no other seminary were we ever allowed to face that window. We had our backs to the window and the shrine, even if it was right on the kitchen wall, the shrine was where we had our backs to the picture window. That was learning for Trungpa Rinpoche.
And I also recall that they had a sort of a passing lane during walking meditation, that if somebody was walking slow, you could actually pass them.
Well, there was one section in the room, which was the section I was in, Rinpoche was on the sort of shrine right, so it was on the that side of the room. There was a sideways section, and that was... that was the comic relief section during walking meditation. Most of the rest of them walked sort of normally, but anyone who didn't feel like it or was in a weird mood would migrate over to this little section, and anything went in this section. There were passing lanes. Ruthie Astor would sometimes walk basically in this super exaggerated, with this saintly look on her face, exaggerated what we now know as kinhin that we'd never heard of. Other people would go in figure eights around two cushions. Other people would run. And all of this was just something to do for entertainment. And we laughed our heads off.
So you were there in the famous moment when Trungpa Rinpoche, for a considerable amount of time, almost a couple of days, almost did not continue teaching Vajrayana.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. This was amazing. He started teaching the Vajrayana teachings. And although everything he had ever taught had been with one view, we knew everything had a Vajrayana flavor, we had never received specific Vajrayana teachings. He started teaching Vajrayana, so this was a very big deal for him. He was finally created the situation where he was going to spill his, you know, this is his real mission in life, to pass on the Vajrayana lineage. And again, he was laying the ground. He started talking about the Abhishekas and the different yanas, and none of us had ever heard anything like any of this. We didn't understand one single word. First, he gave a just kick-ass talk on Samaya. That was fairly understandable, and we all understood that because the Samaya was done with him. Even though we had taken a vow, we all knew we were that connected with him. But then he started in on the yanas and the Abhishekas and all this stuff.
And the eight logos.
Yeah, that was later on. But, you know, basically for a couple of days, and he talked for hours and hours and hours, and you didn't understand a single word. I remember at one point quite early on, maybe the second talk, David Rome very politely raised his hand and said to Rinpoche, right, and Rinpoche called me, said, Rinpoche, and he really was very polite, very respectful. He said, sir, this is all very interesting, but what does it have to do with Buddhism? So that was the start of that. And then the next talk or the talk after, at some point Rinpoche got to a nutra, which is really the Kagyu lineage wealth, and he started talking at 4 p.m. He gave a whole talk for 2 hours. Then he took some questions. Then he started the next talk and went on for hours. And then there was a break, and we thought, this is it. We're finally going to get out of here and get some dinner. And then he said, and now I want to talk about Anutra. And at this point, I think I will leave the names out. One person sitting in the second row, pretty much right at Rinpoche's feet, raised his hand. One person said, Rinpoche, could we continue after dinner? And the person sitting next to him sort of flopped his hand in the air and said, I second that. And Rinpoche stopped and he said, "All right." And then, and you have to remember, I'm sitting about 4 feet from him. I'm practically at his feet. I had an incredible seat. I remember this in slow motion. He reached his hand up and he took the microphone. It was a standing microphone in those days. There wasn't anything else. And he threw the whole stand onto the ground. And I remember, for me, space froze. Everything became solid. I thought my heart had stopped beating. I didn't think I could breathe. And I remember Michael Cohen from the other side of the room, he threw down the microphone, he stood up from the chair and marched out of the room. As he was marching, for me, it was not even possible to think. Everything froze. I've never felt anything like it. And I remember Michael Cohen stood up in the back and he said, "Wait, sir, please wait. He doesn't speak for all of us." And Rinpoche just kept right on going. I remember thinking, how can he stand up? How can he produce a voice? I literally thought I was dead. I thought, that's it. And Rinpoche left, and the whole room just sat there frozen. The whole space was frozen. You know, just not cold frozen either, just immovable. Immovable. And it took me a while, and I realized I was surprised that I was actually still breathing and that my heart was beating, because it was that powerful. And we sat there for a long time, and I remember at some point people started getting up and going outside, just one at a time. I couldn't move for about half an hour. We didn't know if he was ever going to teach again, and from what I understood later, he didn't know himself if he was ever going to teach again. He didn't, you know, that he was pouring his heart's blood out, and this was the reaction he got. And my memory of how it happened, as he was gone for several days, we all walked around in this little hush. He didn't show up for his talks. We sort of tried to have our other classes, but no one knew what to do. We were very bewildered. There was a lot of whispering. Has anyone heard anything? Is he coming back? Nobody knew anything. And then someone came on visit. I remember his face and I can't remember his name, but a guy who was a photographer, and he had been through Tibet and to Bhutan and India and taken all kinds of slides, which was the modern technology then, these wonderful slides. And he was going to do a slideshow for us where he had taken pictures of Lama dancing, or Trungpa Rinpoche was an ex-master of Lama dancing. And so the first time we saw Rinpoche again, he showed up for this slideshow, and he sat next to the slides, and again, he said not one word, and his face was still in what we called, it was black, it's what we call black air. And he sat next to this man, God, the name almost came back, and this guy was showing the slides and going, this is this, and this is this, and this is this, and he was showing all kinds of fabulous things. And at some point, this unbelievable picture of Khyentse Rinpoche came up, and I'd never seen Khyentse Rinpoche before, and this picture came up and was so beautiful. I mean, it just completely stopped my mind. And I remember, and he was going pretty fast, because everyone was nervous, because Rinpoche's mind was out in that room, and everyone was sort of shaky, because it was not easy being around him when he was like that. And that picture came on, and he said, and this is Khyentse Rinpoche, and then he went click, and went on to the next slide. He had this little handheld thing. And when he did that, I remember everything in me said, no, I wanted to lose myself in this face. And so this is the first time we heard Rinpoche's voice again. After he threw that microphone, he said, go back. And the guy, of course, was completely freaked out, said, what? And Rinpoche said, go back. So he went back to this slide of Khyentse Rinpoche, this portrait of Khyentse Rinpoche. And there was dead silence in the room, and we just stared at this unbelievably beautiful face. And there was silence, and it went on for quite a long time, and then Rinpoche started talking. He started telling us about Khyentse Rinpoche. He told about, you know, how important Khyentse Rinpoche was to him. He told us stories about his time with him. And then we went through the whole rest of the slides, and Rinpoche gave all the narration for the slides and told us stories about the Lama dancing. So for me, I don't know if it's true. There's no way to know. My perception was seeing Khyentse Rinpoche open the door and gave him, it was some kind of signal to him that it was okay to keep going. And so after that, the next day, he showed up for his talk and everything just kept right on going. And that was absolutely one of the most scary things I've ever lived through. So powerful. Yeah. So And at that seminary, so he gave us all these teachings. There was no transmission at that seminary, nothing like it. He just gave us this body of teachings and sent us home.
Did you work on editing those transcripts or not?
No, at that point, things were transcribed by volunteers. I transcribed the threefold annulment talk.
The first Samaya.
The first Samaya talk. So it was everyone who was there just took turns, and it was also edited by volunteers. And that was one thing I always wanted to do, was go back and listen to the talks and correct those things. And I guess Judy and Ellen did that. So, yeah.
You are listening to Mosaics on Chronicles Radio, a production of the Chronicles of Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Support for this programming comes from our listening audience. To contribute, visit chroniclesradio.com and click on Support This Work. Thank you for your support, and thank you for listening to Chronicles Radio. Thank you.